It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
All right, welcome to episode number 15 of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. I'm Matt Wardlaw, of course. Jeff Giles is with me, as always. And 15 episodes in, if you're just joining us, we invite you to look back and check out the first 14 episodes. We've had some diverse conversations, including talking with producer Marty Fredrickson, singer-songwriter Bruce Hornsby, Steve Poltz, and most recently, we spoke with Mr. Nat Osborne about his awesome new album. So if you missed any of that, make sure you go back and check all of that out. And we've come a long way in 15 episodes, and it's worth noting that since we started this up in May of 2011, we only did about 7 episodes total in the first 2 years. And now here in 2013, we've done 7 already this year alone, and I think we have a lot more stuff on deck. Jeff, it's almost like we finally figured this podcasting thing out.
Don't say that. You're going to jinx it.
You know what's good? Somewhere in the middle of all this, I managed to annihilate Dave Lifton's podcasting career with the Pop Dose podcast. Or so I thought, because then you guys just did another episode of that one to sadly discuss the recent passing of Phil Ramone.
Yeah, it's always sad when it takes somebody passing away to get the band back together, but It was good to talk to those guys again. But it's always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
It's always a pleasure, for sure. And I like the fact that in that episode, you found a way to turn Paul Simon's 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover into 50 Ways to Leave Your Lifting. That was fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a clever guy.
Well, the final plug I'm going to throw out before we get into things is One for a Fine Mess, the new podcast featuring the very same Jeff Giles that you're hearing here today. I have listen to the first 2 episodes with David Berwald and playwright Ned Massey, and I'm here to offer an endorsement. If you love music, you need to check out A Fine Mess. It is absolutely riveting listening, and Jeff didn't pay me to say that.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
Well, let us get into episode 15 officially here. Today, our guest is Whitfield Crane. You know him best, probably as the frontman for Ugly Kid Joe, the band with whom he achieved multi-platinum success in the early 90s, which included the milestone of having the highest-selling debut EP of all time and the first EP in history to be certified platinum. And that stat right there still floors me to this day. Ugly Kid Joe is back with a new EP called Stairway to Hell. And how can you not be happy about that one? Mr. Whitfield Crane, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, man.
Well, I want to start out with a little bit of history on the group. Just want to go back to the beginning a little bit and have you, I guess, talk a little bit about the origins of the band. And, you know, I'd be interested to hear what your path was to getting signed.
Yeah, record deal. I think we got a record deal in 91. That was with Mercury Polygram. How did that really work? I was in Santa Barbara in a college town called Alta Vista, most densely populated square mile west of Mississippi, a band, and we played where you'd play in a college town, and then there was a thing, there was a radio show for KTYD, I think it was the radio station, and you could get your local band, you could get your song on Sundays on a local night, and so to do that, you had to have a demo. I manifested the demo to do that very thing, and the guy that listened to the demo I gave him just to get on the local show, was like, this is really good. And he took it down to L.A., took it to an entertainment lawyer. That guy heard it. And then, you know, with just from wanting to be on the local radio show, which is really all I wanted, all of a sudden within, you know, a matter of 6-7 months, we had, you know, a major label record deal. And within the year, we were on tour with Ozzy. So it just kind of came out of nowhere, really.
What was the demo thing that, what was the song that got things going for you guys demo-wise? Because, I mean, the EP, that came later, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the demos were probably even sonically better than the EP. I think there was, you know, some obscure songs on there. There was Goddamn Devil was on there. I almost forget. I'm not really sure the exact song. I know Goddamn Devil was on there. There's some obscure songs, like some song called Ghost Town, or I forget what was on that really. But it was a transition thing. Like I wanted to get on that radio station. Klaus, who I don't think he was in the band yet, he uh, he then heard the demos I did that the radio station guy was super into, and then Hoss had not left our hometown of Palo Alto, and we went and tracked some of Klaus's songs. He's like, wow, you can sing. I had no idea. And I said to him, I go, dude, can you please be in the band with me? I've wanted to be in a band with Hoss since I was a little kid. We went to, you know, we grew up together. We went to junior high school together. We went to high school, and he's, you know, he's a kid who could play Eruption in his garage. And I've always been like, oh, man, we should be in a band. It would be great. And, you know, he would just say no, no. And so I went and started my own band, did that demo, and then not only the radio station guy hearing it, but Klaus hearing it, he then wanted to record some of his songs, which are, you know, he's the primary songwriter for the Kid Joe. So I'm pretty sure the tape that got to Mercury or whatever it was an amalgamation of like whatever band I was in at the time and then Klaus's song. If I get my, it's been 20 years, so I'm pretty sure that's the storyline. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there a particular song from that demo that was the one that really got the attention of the major label side of things, or was it just overall, just the sound and what you guys were doing?
I'm not the A&R guy. I don't know. I think probably we played Fill the Void for them at the time, you know, what they needed to do in their stable or whatever. I mean, the demo sounded great. Eric Dodd, who's now, he goes by Eric Valentine, he's an amazing producer, and he grew up with him as well. So he is the producer. So when I say that our demo sounded better than the EP, it did. So I'm pretty sure that, and it was tape, which is the best. And so, I'm not the A&R guy, and I wasn't there, but I imagine they put it in their office, they plugged it in, and they pushed play, and dude, it sounded good. So, you know, the songwriting was pretty good, and the production quality was great. I mean, if you listen to it, it sounded, you know, album quality. So, you know, I would only imagine that was a turn-on for them.
Once you guys were in the major label system, you know, what sort of obstacles did you run up against, if any stuff, as far as things they might have, you know, pressured you to change about the group as it was at that point?
That only ensued after we were already, you know, way past the successful Rubicon. You know what I mean? Like, we made that EP. It's not the best EP in the world, but it had Everything About You on it. And we made that video for Everything About You for $5,000. And they weren't prepared for what went down. And you know, neither were we. We had no idea. We were excited that we had a record deal. We couldn't believe that maybe we could get on Headbangers Ball. You know, we were so excited about everything, really. And, you know, the video, it all went by itself. So, you know, we went from, you know, we released the EP. We had, we didn't really know. We didn't know. We're in a, you know, motorhome touring around with Scatterbrain. And all of a sudden, it started to pick up speed. And then, so by the time, you know, we're finished the Aussie tour and we're getting, I mean, a good pressure, if any, was to go make another record. So, you know, we have this, you know, incredible motion of selling all these CDs. And then, of course, the label wanted us to go make a record, which became America's Least Wanted. And that was a good pressure. You know, we got to meet Mark Dodson, who produced Priest. That's how we picked him. Well, did you really work with Priest? the only pressure was to, you know, to get something out there because there was such a, you know, a head of steam going on. The construct of selling, you know, song or art or whatever is weird to begin with. So, you know, it was weird for me to be in there personally. I can only speak for me in all these storylines because I didn't understand any of it, you know. I mean, it was a lot to take in at that time. I was 24 years old. And, you know, there is politics with music and, you know, inside of a business construct. So, you know, I get a lot more of that now than I did then. But, you know, as far as being challenged by it, it was just a really extreme experience to be inside a business construct that was, you know, selling music or whatever you want to say. But, you know, it was a great experience. I mean, it's very rare. I mean, particularly I know now, looking back at it, you know, to get a record deal at all, you know, that's what we're talking about in this as part of your interview, that's amazing. Just to even get that. But the percentage of bands, particularly in the early 90s, when, you know, record deals meant something, the percentage of a band, bands are going to make it out of that. Let's say 100 bands got signed. It's a 3% that would actually get to go and, move some albums and get to go tour and get to go, you know, around the world and all that. So, you know, we had an amazing run, a great experience. Everyone, including myself, were all super grateful for that. it did come with a lot of bullshit. I mean, but that's what it comes with, you know? And now we're here. 20 years later, we got Stairway to Hell, which is cool. But, yeah, you know, the labels are weird. Business is weird, as you well know.
I wanted to ask you about the learning curve that you went through after coming out of that whole thing with Mercury, because you came up during a time when the label took care of everything. And even now, 13, 14 years after that has kind of gone away, it's still a tricky and sometimes painful process for artists to get their heads around that.
Well, once again, the business of music is interesting. It's certainly the model that was is no more, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, with the computer, you know, and no one's going to go, you're not going to sell a million records, particularly in the demographic of hard rock.
Right.
You're not going to sell money. That's not going to happen. But so then you get stripped down to what? Do you love music? I do. I mean, do you love singing songs? I do. You know, do you want to go tour it? Yeah. At any level. I mean, there it is. So we're self-managed. The band, we're doing it all ourselves. You know, it's not that many people you really need to put on the chessboard, right? And not to say that it's going to work or not work, but, you know, do you want it? Do you want to do it, right? Or do you want to complain? Both choices are acceptable, right? You can complain. There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't have a lot of forward motion. So for me, and once again, I can talk for me, you know, I'm like, you know, I really love singing, you know? And sometimes, in the journey that I've been on, you can forget that. There's a lot of stuff that comes around success. You know, there's a lot of, you know, things that have nothing to do with loving fame. You know, there's a lot of, you've seen it all. So, you know, for now we're in a place where it's kind of like the Wild Wild West. You know, no one knows anything, not really, you know, and that's a good thing. You know, imagine, you know, you could be, you know, in your basement in Pittsburgh, and you could start your band, and you could release it on TuneCore, and who knows, maybe all of a sudden that'll pick up on a viral YouTube thing. Maybe you can go to it or whatever. That guy from where's that guy that's got like a billion hits? Who's that guy?
Which one?
This of the anyway, it doesn't matter. But anyway, so it doesn't matter. Do you like doing what you do? And then go do it. You know, and if you don't, go do something else. It will come down to that.
Yeah, it's just that the old dream was, you know, if you're an artist, that if you love to sing, that's all you want to do. And now, in order to be successful, that is, you can't count on just being able to sing. You've also got to book the gigs. You've got to, I don't know, try to get your tracks placed. You're responsible for so much more. And there are a lot of artists who really aren't temperamentally cut out for that. You know, they're expecting.
I think that's fair. So you find someone to fill that void. I mean, it's all there. Everything's around you every day. Like for me, I like the business side of it now, not 20 years ago. I wasn't ready for it, nor would I ever wanted to do anything like that. Artists are temperamental, and that's acceptable. You know, that's what you get. You get what you get. You always get what you get, and you work with it. And you assimilate, or you hopefully have a malleable spirit to move with it. I can only speak for me, and I'm excited that we got these guys back together in a room, and that we made music, and that it's good. You know, I'm excited that we just toured around Europe from, you know, last year, played fat shows and club shows and soccer stadiums, and I'm excited we're going back to play Polish Woodstock, and you know, it's just it's really cool. Now we're making $1 million. No, do I love doing it? Yeah, I mean, I love it. There's a lot of, you know, it's great. I mean, I love touring. I haven't toured at that level. We just did over the last year, you know, in a long time, and I was like, oh my god, I remember this. You know, it was like oh my god, it's all still here. You know, and it's fun. I mean, I really like it. I know people that don't like it, and that's fair too. You know, it depends. You know, everyone's different. You know, artists are just people, and all, you know, everyone's different. So, you know,
Well, you talked about the current system, and I think, you know, certainly you guys have been able to embrace that, because it's you put out this EP initially yourselves, I guess, last year, and it looks like you got obviously some label interest to, you know, go ahead and kind of do a re-release, you know, this year. So, I mean, it is kind of nice because there really are no rules about what is not okay to do. It's like you can kind of put something out there, you know, do it in the way that you think makes the most sense for you, and see what comes out of that.
Totally true. We put it out on TuneCore. We had, no clue. Who knew? You know, and it people enjoyed it and got a good response, and we gained some great tours out of that. And then for the North America, for Canada and America, we got Missy involved, and I'm like, what do you want to do? Do you want to meet us midstream? And she's like, absolutely. Can you throw some acoustic songs on there? And we did. That's cool. A year ago, if you talked to me, I would have been like, when we did TuneCore, it was two parts. A, that's cool that you can release it with the push of a button around the world in a lot of different formats. And B, in my, I don't know anything, and I was like, no one's going to buy a CD anymore. And I thought maybe hard copy sales and, a pretty heavy inference from my side. I was like, no one's going to buy a CD anyway. The thing is, in Europe and America, people, funny enough, they not to a million sales, but people want to buy hard copy product. So that, enter Missy, enter artwork. I love artwork. So yeah, if you just kind of keep doing what you do, stuff's going to show, show stuff will open up in front of you. You got to push a little, but it's all here. Nobody really knows what they're doing. Where does it start and end? And that's probably with music. Do you think it makes cool music? Is it well received? Do people like it? Do you want to go tour it and so on? So, it's interesting.
Well, I want to talk about some of the tunes, but since you mentioned, physical product, I have to say that the artwork that you guys did for this new EP, Stairway to Hell, just looks awesome. I mean, if you're going to have physical products, the art is very important, and you guys certainly, did it up for the art. The art's great.
Yeah, we like it. Thank you very much. The dream would be vinyl. How cool would that be?
Oh, yeah.
Or cassette.
Or cassette. I like this. I got my grandma, she died in 96 about a year ago, and I got her, my mom was obsessed. She's like, you'll get this car. So I have this car, my grandma's car. It has tape deck. It's awesome.
That's awesome. Head on there for the devil's paradise. Angels on my lap, and the beer is cold as ice. Dirty little deeds are the ultimate sin. I've got the money, let the good times begin. This stuff is good hard rock, and I think what might surprise some people is it sounds current in a way that it could fit very comfortably on the radio next to, Shine Down Hinder or any of those other bands you might want to throw out. Did you guys have a specific direction in mind when you started to work on the material for this record?
No. We threw a bunch of songs in the middle, and we figured we should make an EP, and then whatever songs kind of, were better songs, Like we tracked half of it in L.A. with Sonny Mayo and half of it in New Orleans with Dave Fortman. So we wandered in with having it done into the swamp, and then Dave was like, "I got some songs," and he looked at "No One Survives." And so pretty much, the writing process of this band is always like, we're a big team. We want whatever sounds the best or whatever. But no, we didn't have a specific. I hoped that it was good.
I was going to ask about that. You had been doing the another Animal project with Shannon in the recent past. What was it that, brought the band back together to do Ugly Kid Joe stuff?
Well, I think it was Dave Fortman and Shannon Larkin were making the second Godsmack record together, and I think they were just shooting shit and talking. I wasn't there, but I imagine that they were just, remember that? Dave's a big producer now. So I imagine that we could do this because we can. It was doable. And then, they probably had a couple drinks or whatever they do, and they called Klaus and they called me, and of course my answer to that is, yeah, please, that'd be awesome. It's been a long time, but yeah, why not? So I would think, as far as my recollection goes, it came to Dave Fortman and Shannon.
Is with this record coming out officially here in North America on the 16th, is it something that you guys are going to be able to, go full on and, tour it and all that stuff? What are the plans there?
Well, we want to tour it, for sure. If I had my way, I would tour 6 weeks, a month off, 6 weeks, a month off. But, we need the right, for North America particularly, we need the right tour. We need the right circumstance for us to, to flourish. I don't see us going on the motorhome to the club. But if we can get a good, you know, a good spot on a good tour that makes, you know, sense, then it's on. We're ready to go. Do we have that? Not yet. We don't have a tour yet.
You know, I think that you're a bitch.
I love that you guys got to work with a couple of the Fishbone guys on Love Ain't True. That seems to be an element of the spirit of Ugly Kid Joe's that you guys have always had like a bit of a fraternity that has some far-reaching connections because musically you guys are all into a lot of different things.
I mean, we love Fishbone. We love Judas Priest. We love AC/DC. We love Sabbath. You know, we love all kinds of stuff. And given the opportunity, you know, we'd love to share a stage or share some... on a CD or a record or whatever, but that's true. We love a lot of different music.
Is this stuff that we're hearing on the EP, is this the prelude to like doing a full-length record?
Yeah, I hope so. It would be great. We can do that. It's all in-house now. You know, we have the luxury of Dave Fortman. You know, we're writing songs as we speak, and hopefully we would do that. I can see it happening, for sure.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you for keeping things short and sweet with this EP. I read a recent interview with you where you were talking about how bloated records got in the 90s. And I did a little fist pump because I'm always happy when a record comes in around 10 songs.
Yeah, the thing about the, you know, and understandably, and back to the business of music, is in the 90s you wanted to, the record company and, of course, even the band wanted to get paid full royalties. So a lot of times if you had 10 songs you needed 13 to get to an LP,
right?
So you put like 3 songs that weren't that good on it,
right?
My records, and I once again I can speak from my experience, is, you know, I still love music, but when I grew up, it was like, you know, Sabbath or Priest or AC/DC or Van Halen. Those songs were pretty much those records were like 8 songs long, and I liked that model. So if I can keep it to 8 songs in the near future, I will. If we happen to write 10 to 12 songs that are great, I will do that too. If I'm doing a new project, you know, it's okay to put a bigger record together so that you have a set to play. But for a band like Ugly Kid Joe, you don't really need a, you know, 13-song record. I don't think so.
Right. So then how deliberate was the decision to make this an EP? Because it's kind of like a full circle type of thing. Was it because of that, or was it just because that's the amount of material that you had around?
That's what showed itself. You know, I can't put it more clear than that. Right. You know, if we had sat there and we tuned in some great source and written a double album, then I think we would have done that too. But, you know, I think all we added up was 6 songs. It only took us 15 years, but we got 6 songs done.
That's awesome. You guys have always had a great sense of humor. I mean, the name of the band, I mean, originally Poking, I believe, at Pretty Boy Floyd, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And one of my favorite album titles from the 90s, Motel California. Did you ever hear from anybody in the Eagles organization about that?
No, not at all. I bet they don't even know. They don't know about that. But I never heard anything from the Eagles. We love the Eagles, though. Laughing in the Fast Lane. Awesome.
You guys came out in an interesting time, sort of in the midst of the whole hairband thing, but also at the beginning of the grunge genre.
Right.
Ugly Kid Joe was and still is a very unique band. You know, certainly I think a big part of that was you guys had the sense of humor thing, which was, you know, great. It didn't seem like, you know, you guys took things too seriously. But with what you guys were doing, was it difficult to fit in?
Oh, absolutely. We had no peer group. It was insane. The thing about it is, if I have to trade it in, I trade it in, because here's what you get. We're avid and massive rock and roll fans with, you know, Ozzy or Priest or whatever. So we got, like, we came out of nowhere. We sold all these records. And then we got a tour with our heroes, bottom line. We toured with Van Halen, you know. We toured with Ozzy Osbourne and Motorhead and all these bands, right? And what you asked me was it hard to fit in our peer group? Absolutely. It was, you know, we didn't come up with anybody. We're from Santa Barbara, right? So we didn't have a scene. So on that level, yeah, it was interesting because, you know, there's a lot of bands, particularly young bands like ourselves at the time, they're all vying for the same space. So, you know what? When I got a record deal, I thought that everyone that ever got a record deal would feel like I felt. I was like, oh, we're all best friends. It's awesome. And that wasn't the case. You know, I really thought that, though. I thought that I was part of some new amazing fraternity, which I am, but not at the level I thought I was. You know, I thought that everyone would just be stoked. And, you know, understandably, you know, we didn't have a peer group on our side. And it was a challenge, to say the least. But, you know, if you had to trade it in to go on tour with Ozzy or Motorhead or Van Halen or Jovi or Def Leppard and go do those experiences, which were incredible, you know, I mean, that's what we got with it. We got adopted by the old guard, and you kind of like, we got the raising face from our peer group. Like, eh.
It sounds like an amazing ride. I still think that if I were in your shoes by the mid-90s, it would have been tough for me not to be bitter, because if you guys had come up 10 years earlier, you would have been supported by your peers, probably, because you were making...
Yeah, you know, I would say that it's an interesting chain of events. You know, I lived through them. What do you have control of? Both of you guys have control of nothing, nor do I, except how things affect you, right?
Right.
So, of course, when, you know, you go from selling millions of records to all of a sudden that's that, and you're sitting there and you feel like you got your game together and you feel like, you know, wow, I can finally do this. Like you're operating at a pretty high level, and then there's no outlet. That's an interesting moment, you know, and I suppose the effect of that moment would affect everyone a little differently. You know, I made it through it. It was a heavy time, you know. It's a weird thing to do because you have all your dreams that have manifested, and then you have, and then they're gone. So the trick there is to be grateful that you were able to have those experiences. But the understandable feeling that you might have is like, damn, I wish I was doing more of this. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a bitter is an acceptable way to react to that, because you know that's what it would garner. But equally, probably in a more original and manifestation or effect that it would have on someone if lucky enough would be, you know, to make it through and get back to where, you know, I'm sitting talking to you guys. I mean, it was gnarly. But one of the greatest things was I got to go sing with Life Agony and really go jump into the fire. Imagine that. Imagine me singing with LOA for a year.
Oh, yeah.
That was rad.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that because, I mean, that's pretty much that was the first thing you did after that was, you know, picked up and did the Life of Agony thing. And I remember because I was doing a metal radio show at the time that you got that gig and people were going, what the hell is this? And but then I started hearing...
Yeah.
Then I started hearing from people, they're like, you know what, we went out and we saw LOA, and dude, Whitfield totally kicks ass with these guys. You know, against the odds of like a lot of people that were going, man, this is not going to work, you pulled it off.
I did pull it off, and it was totally acceptable and understandable quandary for people's brains. Ugly Kid Joe singing in LOA, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But check it out. I jumped in the fire, I survived it, and really, funny enough, I evolved vocally in that band, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, I had to take on a new character. Those guys are great. I get along with the East Coast peoples more than not. You know, I went from, I'm going back to what your buddy was saying there. He's like, yeah, that might have made you bitter. No, it made me like, what do I do? And Scott Ian said, you should go join this band, and I did that. So I went from this weird feeling of, like, what do I do to... To every show started with LOA, of people like, what is that? And then, dude, I tell you, it was a great challenge, rose to the occasion, and, you know, those guys are, you know, my dear friends now. Awesome.
I wondered about that time, too. Like, if you ever had a moment where you were able to sit down and readjust and try to put together a plan, or if it was just a one-day-at-a-time type of situation where stuff came your way and you had an opportunity to take it.
Well, it really comes down to me being in my way or me getting out of my way, right?
Uh-huh.
So, and there's plenty, I think I can speak, I mean, you guys probably, can identify with that. I'm a master of getting in my own way. I'm a master of making some opportunities happen, and lately I'm a master of getting out of my own way. I'm a day-to-day guy anyway, you know, right. Even right now, talking to you on the phone, you know. I don't really have a big master plan, but I'm pretty sure that and felt that something would work out. You know, I hoped at least, and not to say that it would, but you know, a lot of stuff has worked out. That 98 Oz boost, I got LOA on the 98 Oz Fest, and I met a bunch of cool guys there. We made a band called Medication, and lived in Hollywood for a couple of years, and tried to get off the ground, and didn't quite make it. And then did the Another Animal thing with Shannon. That was an amazing call. I was living back in Palo Alto, California, a town that I was born and raised in, and I was like, I'll never go back here. And there I was. And I felt like living in my sister, in the back of my sister's nice, beautiful home in a guest cottage, and all my musical travails, they all felt like it was a dream. Like nothing felt real. I was like, oh wow, I guess that's over. And I was like, oh wow.
Right.
And then about 3 years into that, Shannon called me, and he had this Another Animal band, and their singer, you know, for the singer they're using, whatever reason, didn't happen. He goes, man, can you get here in a week? And I go, for what? And he said, to be in this band, Another Animal. I go, what am I going to do? He's like, just show up. And so I did that. And I got Shannon Larkin. We all look up to Shannon Larkin. We love Shannon. He's like, man, what a neat guy. What a talent. What a great friend. And so I showed up to do the LOA stuff. And those guys are all the Godsmack guys, right? And they're like, what? You know, once again, the Ugly Kid Joe guy. But they all believe in Shannon, and I believe in Shannon. So, boom, I walk in, and they're all kind of looking at me, and like, okay, we'll see what he's got. And 21 days from me walking, you know, into that moment, the Another Animal record was tracked and done and powerful and awesome. So, you know, I think that really, you know, when I'm sitting back in my sister's house, and I'm like, oh, wow. I guess it's over. And then Shannon out of the blue calls me and says, dude, it's not over. Get over here and such. So that really, you know, I mean, thank you. I'm like, oh, whew, this could happen, you know? And, you know, timing and luck, right? I mean, it's great to be lucky. It's great to, you know, it's great to be good. It's great to be lucky. It's really great to be both. So, you know, every now and then things work, right?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I'm staying right now in front of Lee Richards. He just picked me up at the hotel during this interview. We're tracking Lee Richards is a guitar player and songsmith from Another Animal. I'm standing in Boston right now, or Andover, and I'm going to go into a house studio that I've been in the last 5 days, and I'm going to track, and I'm in the midst of tracking an entire acoustic record. So the goal for me, the goal for Uncle Joe, and I think pretty much all my friends that play music, is to make music and tour and move forward with it all. So, you know, I'm knee deep in it all. It's real exciting times.
Well, I know you probably have one. So I would love to hear a good story from your time, from each of your times, you know, touring with Ozzy and then Van Halen.
Who do you want, Ozzy or Van Halen?
A story from each.
Eddie Van Halen, which is awesome. I love Eddie. We get along fabulously. We're on tour with Bon Jovi, Van Halen, and Ugly Kid Joe. Straight up soccer stadiums, 1995. 40,000 to 80,000 people sold out half when you went on stage, right? Eddie Van Halen and Michael Anthony's the greatest guy ever. Alex Van Halen's a conspiracy theorist, awesome dude, and the Van Halen guys were just so cool, and they'd come sit with us and talk with us, and we'd be like, no way, it's Van Halen, and it was totally normal, you know what I mean? Like the dudes from your high school posters of your wall of your room, they're walking out of the posters and they're like, hey, and we're like, yes, and so I got along with all those guys, and then this is how rad Eddie Van Halen is. So boom, we play a huge soccer stadium in Portugal. I'm walking off stage or whatever it is, and Eddie Van Halen's walking on stage, and by this time we have a good rapport, and I go, hey, and he has his guitar, he's walking on stage to go rock, and I go, hey, Eddie, he goes, hey man, how's it going, how was the show? And I'm like, oh, it's pretty good. And then kind of just joking around, I go, hey man, if you ever need some guitar lessons, dude, I'm right here for you. And he goes, hey man, and he looks at me all kind of stern, and he goes, hey, if you ever need anything, you call me. And I go, and right there, you made the mistake. I go, right there, I go, hey, man, I want a whole stack. I want an Eddie Van Halen stack. I want the whole thing, and I want it sent to whatever address I give you after this tour. And I look right at his face, and he goes, done. Boom. Fast forward, tour's over, And, you know, I have his number, and I'm not going to forget that, you know? And not that I lived anywhere at the time, but I knew Klaus's address. And I called up Eddie. He's like, hey, man, I'm all still here. I'm ready for my stack. he goes, oh, yeah, what's the address? And I gave him the address, and I looked at Klaus. I told him later, hey, dude, by the way, Eddie Van, and Klaus Eichstadt, the guitar player from the guitar, his hero, one of his heroes is Eddie Van Halen, and rightly so. I go, by the way, Eddie Van Halen sending you a stack. And he's like, what? And then, boom, whatever, UPS, whatever truck was, came, and boom, there it was, the PV stack, the whole thing, 5150 head. Oh, by the way, your phone number has 5150 in it.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a fan.
Cool. Anyway, so there's a Van Halen story for you. There's lots more of those, but yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. No, it's funny. I got a chance to interview Michael Anthony about a year and a half ago, and anytime I interview somebody from that camp, I'm always ready for them to, like, you know, call. And well, first of all, if you're one of those guys, you might see the phone number and go, oh, God, I'm going to talk all about Van Halen or whatever. But he called up, you know, just completely cool, great interview. But the person that actually called me out on the phone number was when I interviewed about 3 months ago, Mick Jones from Foreigner, who, of course, did the 5150 record. He called up and he's like, I like that phone number.
Yeah. There you go. Me and Mick Jones. Gotcha on the number.
Well, what about Ozzy, man? Good Ozzy story.
Ozzy stories, man. There's lots of Ozzy stories, man. We got out there in 1992. No More Tours tour. It's Ugly Kid Joe, Motorhead, and Ozzy Osbourne. And we were like, no way, we got this tour. We're so excited. We can't believe it. I mean, it was over the moon. And but you know, Ozzy is sober. And then we're total drunks, and we're at college, and you know, everyone pulls us aside, and they're like, "You guys, be careful with your booze. You know, you guys have to stop this." And we're like, "Okay." But if all things that would stop us from, you know, pushing that envelope would be the Ozzy tour and being respectful of Ozzy for sure. Whatever that dude needs, we're down. And so we'll get there. And we're kind of, you know, we're nunnish. We're like, okay, we're not being our normal selves, but we're excited and we're grateful and we're stoked. And then all of a sudden, you know, first year we go back with, and then two huge proper cases of beer, bottled beer, from Ozzy. And we were like, huh, this trip was a trick. And it turned out it wasn't a trick, and he ordered us to drink. And we're like, yes, this is awesome. And the equal thing that he would do, and he still probably does, is he loves glass stink bomb. So they're really putrid and disgusting and great. So a glass stink bomb is like if you smash it, it's so foul. So after, he'd always have a grip of those in his hand, a big handful of them. And so we'd come off stage, and then we'd cruise in, all post, you know, show, very excited. This is our biggest, you know, these are incredible shows. And then the door would open, and there would be Ozzy with his makeup on, looking at us just like you would think he would look, like just like Ozzy Osbourne, with this crazy Ozzy look, the eye of a madman. And we'd be all, oh, no, and he'd run in, this crazy Ozzy run. He'd throw the stink bombs on the ground and smash them and go, hi, ha, 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 and then we were like, ah. We started trying to put locks on the door. I mean, then he would start stink bombing us before we even got there. So, you know, so it was awesome. He's a funny guy.
That's totally awesome. Well, hey, I want to move towards wrapping up here and just ask you, cool. I want to ask you if there's a song from the Ugly Kid Joe catalog that you feel like it didn't get the proper notice that it deserved, and, you know, we'd love to hear your thoughts on that song and from your view, perhaps, why you think it was overlooked.
The entire Menace to Sobriety record, album, CD, that whole record, no one even knows it exists, it's badass. 1995, Menace to Sobriety is, you know, a great album. So I would say that entire album, not just the song.
What was it I was just going to say, what was it that kept that record down?
Oh, timing, you know, that was when grunge was at its peak. I was busting out Rob Halford heavy metal screams on it. It was the most unwanted sound to come out of a vocalist ever. We were metal, as always, there's a lot of different styles on that record, but it's a rock record. It's a hard rock record. It's awesome. And that was, you know, whatever, 1995, it was an unwanted, it wasn't happening for that. But that doesn't take away from the fact it's amazing, you know?
Yeah.
So, if you're asking me a song, I'm going to give you that one.
Well, all right. Final bit here. I want to go back and just ask, because that made me think of something. And that is, what was it that put you on Life of Agony's radar? What was it they heard in your voice that they were like, man, we got to get this guy in here?
No. It was straight up as everything is. It's all who you know. I'm wonderful. One of my dearest friends is Scott Ian. He plays guitar in a band called Anthrax.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I got back and I just got back from India and I was all, fuck, you know, I have no band. And I was talking to Scott on the landline and it was before cell phones. And he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know, dude. I'm on a band. It was really weird. 7 years of just constant touring. And he's like, dude, you should be in Life of Agony. I'm like, really? What is that storyline? And it's a weird storyline because it's supposed to split since your son was done. And I don't know if that's ever happened. I live a lot of weird experiences. Name another singer that went in. Singer. Now, bass player, understandable. Drummer, understandable. Guitar player, understandable. But name a different moment in time and space for rock music where a record was done and the lead singer split and some dude pinch hit for that tour. It's insane. But anyway, that had nothing to do with my vocal. I didn't even know if I could get that vocal done. Scott Ian said, go there. I was on the way to go see the original Black Sabbath play in Birmingham at the NEC, and on the way, so I went to New York, tried out for LOA, went and saw Sabbath, got the call, and they said, yeah, you got it. And then but if you're asking me, it was it really comes down to, I believe in Scott and they do, you know. So that, I mean, that's what it's the same thing with Shannon and the Godsmack guys, you know. It's just like that.
Well, that's awesome. What else do you want folks to know?
What's that?
What else do you want folks to know?
I don't understand one word you said.
Sorry, I just said...
it's a common problem.
No, I don't. You said it like this. Hang on my gun now.
That's what it sounds like most of the time, actually. But what I actually said was...
it's because he usually has a mouthful of taco.
Wrapping up, I just wanted to ask... what else is there that you want people to know?
Oh, we got the EP out, Stairway to Hell, April 15th. It's got six electric rock tracks. Each one of those tracks, each one of the six tracks is a different vocal character, which is cool. And then we put three acoustic songs on the end of the electric song, and they're great. There's a song in particular on there called Would You Like to Be There, written by Dave Foreman, which is amazing. We really captured something beautiful acoustically. And we're excited. So Stairway to Hell, April 16th. Looking forward to touring in North America, let alone the world, and life is good. There you go.
Awesome. And uglykidjoe.net is where folks can find info on everything Ugly Kid Joe related that they might ever need to know about. Well, thank you, man. Thank you, man, for joining us today on this. This has been fun.
Okay, good. Hey, you guys are very nice, and thank you for taking time out of your day to tell the universe about UKJ's mighty return.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, episode 15 of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. We'll wrap it up there. You can email us with your feedback to mattandjeff@popdose.com. And our big thanks to Whitfield Crane for hanging out with us here and talking a lot of music. And hey, we've already told you, but the new EP is great. Stairway to Hell absolutely should be in your collection. And for those of you that love the physical product like I do, get the actual CD because the artwork is cool. So we'll wrap it up there.